Bien, nous allons donc commencer le premier séminaire de l'année et je suis très heureux d'accueillir le professeur Paul Gueckeyre qui a fait le déplacement de l'Université catholique de Leuven en Belgique. Paul Gueckeyre est un spécialiste de la dyslexie qu'il étudie depuis de nombreuses années, mais il étudie aussi d'autres difficultés du développement et notamment la dyscalculie. Il a réalisé de nombreux travaux. Il est notamment l'auteur d'un article important dans Science, je crois qu'on en entendra parler un tout petit peu, en IRM, où il a pu montrer que les enfants dyslexiques souffraient peut-être d'un syndrome de disconnexion. Je ne vous en dis pas plus, mais si vous travaillez sur ce sujet, cet article de Science est extrêmement intéressant. Je voudrais souligner aussi que je suis très heureux d'accueillir un collègue de Belgique pour être le premier à nous parler cette année des troubles 10. Je pense que notre pays a beaucoup à apprendre de ce qui se passe dans les autres pays en matière de prise en charge des enfants avec des difficultés. Et dans le cas de la Belgique, maybe I should switch to English, but I want to say clearly that Belgium is, in many respects, a model for how children with difficulties are identified, are diagnosed precociously, and in many cases are able to be helped by the school system and by the orthophony system. So thank you very much for accepting to come here and tell us about your latest research. The title of the lecture, Auditory Temporal Processing Theory about Dyslexia.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to start with thanking my colleague for inviting me. It's really an honor to be here in Paris in this prestigious Collège de France to talk about our research. And I want to excuse me, although I'm a Belgian, I'm coming from the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, and my French is not at the level, proficiency level, to give a lecture in French. Je m'excuse, but the lecture will be in English. And one of the reasons is also I do not know most of the, you may say, technical terms of our field in French. We are always also at our lab, since we have an international research group. We are talking more or less daily in English about our research. So today I hope I will give you an idea about one of the actual theories concerning dyslexia. Dyslexia, you may say, the specific learning disorder in the development of reading and or spelling. And more, it's a theory we are involved now for more than 10 years, the auditory temporal processing theory about dyslexia. And I want to present you some of our research findings at the behavioral as well as at the neural level. Okay, I'm not sure how your prior knowledge is about dyslexia, but I want to give some at least introduction on the central theory that is trying on the cognitive level to say what is the cause or what can be the cognitive deficit underlying dyslexia. And you may say one of the mainstream theories in concerning dyslexia is the phonological deficit theory. And I go very briefly over it. One of the things that there is a lot of consensus about in the dyslexia research field is that dyslexia has something to do with phonological awareness. And phonological awareness is the ability we have to play with the sound structure of our language. So being aware of rhymes, for instance, is one of the first, you may say, things we are able in being playing with the sounds independently of semantics of the what the words are meaning. So rhyme awareness is one of these first things, skills we have. It goes to syllable awareness, being able to, you may say, split up words into syllables and know that words consist of several parts. And it ends up with what we call phoneme awareness, being aware that words, especially in alphabetic languages, words are made of individual phonemes and the quality of how these phonemes are represented in our cognitive system determines in a high way the quality also of how we make or we learn these connections between graphemes and phonemes. And that's what reading is really about. What is happening in reading is connecting the sounds, the phonemes, to the graphemes, the written forms of words. And especially in the first phase of learning to read, reading via decoding, making these connections grapheme per grapheme, it is especially this phonemic awareness that is of a high value. A second phonological skill, although there is some discussion about it, is rapid automatized naming. We are testing it with this kind of test, so naming in a serial way, very as fast as possible, a bunch of objects or colors or numbers or letters. And the idea is that the speed of retrieving the sounds connected to that picture, to that color, to the digit or the letters, the speed of retrieving the phonological code of these kind of things determines also the speed of reading, of direct or immediate word recognition, you may say. And that's especially this rapid automatized naming is especially important for reading via direct word recognition. And that's when we take into consideration these both sub-skills, you may say, or phonological skills, we come to what is called the double deficit theory about dyslexia, where some kids have serious reading problems, resistive reading problems, because of serious problems in the phoneme awareness, while others have serious reading problems based on problems in serial rapid naming, you may say, in retrieving in a fast way phonological codes. And some kids, and it seems to be the most worse cases, have problems with both of these skills. There is something also in the phonological domain, I go not into detail, about verbal short-term memory. Our working memory and verbal short-term memory is especially liking to work with what we call phonological codes. If we try to remember something, we use a phonological loop in order to be able to hold it at least for a certain period into our mind. These are the, you may say, mainstream theory about dyslexia as a phonological deficit. There is, of course, and I know here the colleagues and parents are also involved in that, there is besides also more visual line on orthographical skills, but I suppose it will be available here in courses at Paris. The auditory temporal processing theory I want to talk with you about is building upon this phonological deficit theory. And it started already some decades ago with first studies, especially Paula Talal was involved, an American colleague was involved in that kind of research, finding out that especially in dyslexic, but also in kids with specific language impairments, the same kind of disorder or disability at the level of spoken language, find out that kids have problems in the auditory domain, and it's called temporal because it has to do with changes or in the auditory stimuli, in the auditory information we are processing, or it has to do with rapid auditory information. So rapid, dynamic changes over time, that's what's called auditory temporal deficit. Talal especially did on gap detection, meaning that if we have, for instance, if we present a certain noise to persons, and in that noise we make a gap, persons with dyslexia need a bigger gap to hear it. So this very quick changes in an auditory stimulus is maybe not that well informed. The idea is, how can we link this kind of very, very basic perceptual deficit to, you may say, reading and spelling problems, what is the behavioral manifestation of dyslexia. And that is based on phonological deficit. Well, together with some colleagues, we came out to the idea that the auditory deficit, and I will explain later on, is influencing the way we are perceiving speech. And the way we are perceiving speech is influencing how we represent phonemes in our cognitive system. And so what is already known from phonological deficit theory, this phonemic representations has an influence on reading and spelling problems. And I will talk also a little bit about, you may say, the neural underpinnings we are trying to find out for this kind of problems in the brain. The underlying rationale is sound. What is sound? It's what I'm doing to you now is I try to vibrate the air around you, and sound is vibrations with a specific frequency and amplitude. And especially in speech, if we want to, what you are trying to do now, to perceive speech, it requires you to track in a very accurate way, very rapid transitions in frequency and amplitude. That is what we call auditory temporal processing. As you see here, a sentence like, where were you last year, Sam? There are all kind of transitions in the fine structure you see, very, very, very quick. In the more envelope around, there are all kind of transitions in frequency and amplitude we have to track in order to be able to perceive what is said in an accurate way. And so on, the next step, speech perception, may be the basis of good phonological representations. If we are very well able in perceiving differences between phonemes, and I will give examples later on, if we are able to perceive differences and have a clear distinction between, for instance, certain phonemes, we will build up better phonological representations that will help us in making these kind of connections between graphemes and phonemes and help us in being able to read in an accurate way. One of the studies I want to present is Bart. Bart was the main author of the science paper, but I will not talk about this here at the moment. One of the studies we did in that domain is what you may call a prospective longitudinal study with kids at family risk, where we did, we measured all these kind of phonological deficits, speech perception deficits, and auditory temporal processing deficits already before the age of learning to read and write in Flanders. So we did measurements already at 5-6 years old in kindergarten in Flanders. Formal instruction starts at 6-7 in Flanders in grade one. So measuring auditory temporal processing, speech perception, and phonological deficit was done in third kindergarten and in grade one. And we linked it later on in grade one and grade three to their reading and spelling skills. What is specific for this kind of studies? One of the things is, I don't know whether you are used to it, but dyslexia has a prevalence of about 5%, if I go roughly. If you want a serious group to do statistical analysis on it, and you start before learning to read, you need at least a very, very big group in order to get 20, 25 dyslexic kids at the end. That's one of the problems. We make use of the knowledge that dyslexia is a very genetic thing. So if in a male line it goes up to more or less 40 to 50% of sons of a father with dyslexia will get dyslexic later on. So what we are doing is we take kids from families where one of the parents has been diagnosed as dyslexic. So we had 31 high family risk kids at pre-reading age, and we matched them very, very neatly with kids from the same class, since And I've heard a little bit the last part of the talk of Professor De Haan here. Of course, in learning to read, environment had a lot of impact. If we want to see at the individual level what is happening, we must be sure that the environment, that the instruction is the same. So we are taking kids from more or less the same socioeconomic status, the family environment more or less the same. So the same school, the same class if possible. So we match kids with, you may say, classmates of third kindergarten with more or less the same IQ, more or less the same age. As we know, there is a lot of impact also of age, the birth month and scholastic achievement is very well linked in our system. And kids from the same class. And that's how this kind of family risk studies work. Of course, for the rest, all kids were Dutch-speaking. No other problems were mentioned in their development history and so on. So we try to... It came out, and that's already an idea about the genetic impact. It came out, we tested them in first and third kindergarten, also later on, and we defined dyslexia, it's a research-based definition, not a clinical-based definition, as scoring below the 10th percentile on standardized word reading and spelling tests in grade 1 and grade 3. So you may say the backwardness in reading and or spelling must be consistent, persistent over time in these kids. So a low score in the low 10th percentile, below the 10th percentile in grade 1 and in grade 3, and we came out to 16 dyslexics in our total population. And as you see, in the high-risk family group of more or less 30 kids, 31, 11 of them fulfilled that criterion, while in their matched group, only 5 of 30 came out to match that criterion, what means that we can say that dyslexia seems to be very hereditary here in also in our group. So we mixed, for statistical reasons, both groups of the so-called dyslexic readers and came out with a group of 16. And we had normal readers from that family risk group, 20 kids and 26 from the other families without family history of dyslexia. If we look at their reading, we see that, of course, the dyslexics have a persistent, but that's by definition, as well in word reading as in pseudo-word reading, they are scoring low. But what we see in phonological awareness is that even at certain times, if we go until grade 3, phonological awareness measures here measured by phoneme deletion tasks, so deleting in Dutch, kast without s is kat, this kind of tests or spoonerisms, substitute phonemes in words. We see that even from first grade to third grade, kids with dyslexia become less and less proficient compared to their the other groups. The same for rapid naming. As you see, kids that came out later on to be dyslexic already at the start of first grade have, you may say, a lower achievement in rapid naming. And more or less the same, although not for non-word repetition here, but more or less the same we have for verbal short-term memory, but that will skip. So the dyslexic group shows a broad and enduring phonological deficit. Even phoneme awareness, it increases over time. The normal reading kids from a family, as you have seen, are in between the both. So maybe you may say the genetic link in the family may at first hinder their phonological development and not necessarily the link to reading. Maybe there are other factors come into picture. So, but it seems as family risk for dyslexia is not a one or zero condition, but seems to be continuous in these kind of families. Phoneme awareness is most strongly related to accuracy of reading, so that decoded reading comes into picture here, and RAM is mostly related to speed in reading, especially as you see here in the later phases of development. So what we see here is more or less, you may say, evidence for that phonological deficit theory. What about auditory and speech perception processing? Well, the kind of things we are doing in the auditory processing to see whether kids are able in processing dynamic auditory stimuli, one of the tests we are using is frequency modulation tests, and that's we're doing in an interactive video game, since this psychophysical testing is very boring if you don't, to motivate 5-6 years old to do this kind of, I will let you hear, this is a steady state, and in one of the three we have a modulated tone, so where the frequency is going up and down. What we are doing via a psychophysical experiment is lowering the degree of, you may say, modulation, and see what modulation still persons still need to hear where in one of these three eggs the little baby dragon is coming out. You can hear it if you listen at the eggs. This is the result. If they are correct, there is a baby dragon coming out. And we see that if we look here, as you remember, the kids who are dyslexic, we only decided that they are dyslexics in third grade. But we tested already in the third kindergarten. And what you see is that these kids that came out later on in third grade to be dyslexic, at least to be persistent bad readers, are really different from the others. Also from high-risk families or low-risk families without reading problems. So you see that at kindergarten level, the frequency modulation they need is 10 hertz versus, you may say, more or less 7 hertz. It means they need more of depth of modulation to hear the difference. So there is a group effect. The dyslexics are really more bad already in kindergarten, before learning to read. So these kind of things cannot be a consequence of reading or learning to read. It is already there before. What do we in the field of speech? We are using several tests. Two I want to present is speech in noise perception. What we are doing there is we are presenting kids with speech-weighted with noise. So through the headphones they get noise, and in that noise we are presenting monosyllable words at a certain signal-to-noise ratio level. So minus 1 dB, minus 4 dB, or minus 7 dB. And we try, the kids have to say what they hear. So do they perceive words within a noisy environment? It's one of the speech perception tests that's normally also used for especially kids using hearing aids or cochlear implants. It's very used in these fields. And a second I will talk about later on is categorical perception. But when we look at speech and noise perception, we see again the same picture. Kids who seem to be dyslexic later on in their development, already in kindergarten, at the several signal-to-noise ratios, minus 1, minus 4, minus 7 dB, compared to the noise we are giving at 70 dB hearing level, we see that they understand 10% less words in this noisy environment. What is very impressive. We don't see it anymore. We don't see differences once they are in grade one. So there is a speech and noise problem at the kindergarten level, but not anymore at the first grade level. A second kind of speech perception task we are using is categorical perception. Categorical perception is a way to see how well phonemes are built up, represented in our system. And what you see here is more or less, in an elementary form, the audiogram of two words, two Dutch words, bak and dak. And what you see that bak and dak is only different in, you may say, the shape of the second format. It's how intense, you may say, the it's or intensity curves of time over the frequency bands in the sound. And what you see is that in the second format, the frequency is going up in bak, and the frequency is coming down in dak. If you have an, you may say, an ideal version of bak and dak, it would, as you see, it's only this change in the second format, in certain frequency levels within speech, that there is a difference between bak and dak. So you have to be very accurate in detecting these quick changes in order to be able to see the difference between bak and dak. What we have done in our experiment, and that's a classical one in the perception domain, is as we have here a regular bak and here an ideal version of dak, via synthesized, via the computer, we are in 10 steps, physically equal steps, we are changing here the second format. All the rest stays the same, but only in that frequency domain we are bringing up this second format from going up to coming down. And what you have then, I will let them hear from 1 to 10, and you will see, you will start with bak, and at a certain moment, I hope, you will perceive dak. It's, you should keep in mind, I will let you hear from a physical part of point of view, 10 different stimuli. And you will hear only two words, I think, I hope.
Bak, 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 bak.
So, as you've heard, we are changing in a continuous way, you may say, in a very stepwise way, from bak to dak, and now we are presenting kids with, and adults also, with these 10 stimuli, of course, in a random order. And what you expect, that is that for the first stimuli, more or less nobody will say it is dak. And for the last ones, everybody will say it's dak. And in between, there will be some hesitations. 80% dak. People will... what we see, what we expect in normal readers, people who have a good categorical perception, that is that there is a certain transition. You hear bak until, for instance, 4, and from 5 on, systematically, you hear dak. There is a certain transition with a sharp, it means that you have a sharp boundary made. That's also what we use, let's talk about second language learning, when we are born, we are able to detect all these kind of differences. And we lose the ability to hear the difference between these 10 steps because we don't need it. And it's better, since if the sir here on the first line would say bak and someone else would say bak and we would analyze it, it would be different. But we need to hear the same, so we learn by our development to lose these differences so that we have stable view about what a b and a d is in our language, since there is a... And depending on your language, on your native, on your mother tongue, you lose some things that in another language would be useful. The most famous known difference between a r and an l that is not significant in, for instance, Chinese or Japanese languages. Why, and that's the reason why people within a mother tongue of Chinese have so difficult with our language in making a difference between a r and a l in their language. So they have this kind of... That's what we try to test here. The idea is that for persons with dyslexia, this transition will be less steep and will be less categorical. There will be more hesitations, more uncertainty about what is happening here. And that continuum, since there is a dynamic change in its second format, in a certain aspect of that auditory material, information, Bada is a very good speech continuum, really tapping into that temporal aspect, dynamic changes, and not steady state changes. We used it, of course, again, if you do these kind of things with young kids, we build it in a video game, so they heard the word, and the kid has to say, oh, is the cat sitting in her buck? Or is she sitting on the roof? The duck is the meaning of the word roof, so integrated in a video game. And what we see is that at kindergarten, there is a difference, significant difference in this slope. As you see, the blue line here is the line of the dyslexics, and it's less steep than the two other groups. So, well, especially significant here with the red one, the normal readers from the low-risk families. But if you look at the first grade data, you see that the dyslexics, the blue line, maybe it seems not like that, but that's statistics, the blue line is different from the red and the green, where there is no difference between. So dyslexics seem to be already at that young age, at kindergarten age, before learning to read, seem to be less categoric in this kind of thing. So there is some evidence for consistent deficit in categorical perception in the dyslexic reading group. And it may indicate that our theory about the impact of speech perception on phonological skills, it may indicate that their phoneme boundaries are less well specified, so that they don't hear that well the difference between especially these consonants in that domain. We see, if we look at the whole picture, cross-sectional correlations between all these kind of skills, so frequency modulation, speech and noise, categorical perception, at least the slope of that phenomenon. Phonological awareness and reading is very highly correlated at every age. Even there are high predictive correlations between frequency modulation, speech and noise, categorical perception, and phonological awareness in grade one, and the reading development. But to be honest, most of our predictive correlations disappear when we take into account autoregressive effects, meaning that if we look, of course, if you're in grade three or in grade one, your proficiency in phonological awareness in kindergarten will have its impact. That's what we call within the skill. That's the autoregressive effect. If we take into consideration the within-skill correlations, then the between-skill correlations predictively disappear. So we see in preschool and in grade one that dyslexic kids have problems with this low-level auditory processing, especially this frequency modulation, so in the dynamic domain, speech perception and phonology. So at least it implies that these kind of problems are already present before they learn to read. Together with a significant predictive correlation, you may say it's a suggestive for a causal relation, but we must be very careful with causal interpretations. We cannot demonstrate a robust directional relation between these kind of auditory processing and speech perception and phonology towards reading, so more research is done. Something about maybe practical implications. Of course, if these kind of things are already available before learning to read, possibly these kind of skills can help us in early detection of dyslexia. As we all know, of course, dyslexia can only be with a high accuracy be detected after some period of learning to read after a period of reading instruction. But at the same time, we know that the earlier we can start with treatment, and maybe already before, there are some preventive treatment programs that are very effective. If we could do kind of preventive actions already in kindergarten, it could help. So early detection of at risk is a very important thing, and maybe this kind of skills can help. A second thing, especially what I'm always talking about to our teachers in kindergarten, is you should keep in mind the speech and noise perception problems of dyslexics. Suppose that when listening to my talk here, 10% of the words disappear. You didn't perceive them well. Instruction will not come in the same way as with your colleagues. And I don't know how it's in France, but if I'm going to a kindergarten class, and there is all kind of phonological training, letter knowledge training already in kindergarten classes in our, but if I go to a kindergarten class in Flanders, that's a noisy environment. I was always happy when I brought my kids there that I didn't need to stay there. It's so noisy environment. Well, you should keep in mind, especially kindergarten teachers, that these kids who develop later on dyslexia lose in this kind of noisy environment may lose 10% of the speech. So in an instruction environment, hearing every word very accurately is an important thing. There are some treatment possibilities, especially in the auditory domain, that has been proposed, like fast-forward program of Mike Merksenich in the United States. But at least what I've seen until now is they are still controversial and not what we would call evidence-based. At least we in Leuven, we are now working in collaboration with the engineering faculty at a game on the tablet where we build in letter knowledge, phoneme awareness tasks, but also frequency modulation, detection, these kind of things. We hope to bring in also speech and noise perception in order a kind of an intelligent game to do this kind of psychophysics already in kindergarten and with the school psychology services in Flanders. PMS center of earlier time, so we try to kind of implement this kind of game in third kindergarten, at least for those kids. The kindergarten teacher is thinking they may be at risk for dyslexia, so that's ongoing stuff at the moment, and I must say using this kind of ways of testing, doing this kind of boring psychophysics with kids, they are very, very motivated in ending up the game. They have to help RoboDog, a kind of Diesel X he is calling, a robot dog who has to fight against the cats in the city who are stealing the money and all these kind of things, and they are very excited in. And while playing the game, we are testing their frequency modulation thresholds, we are testing their letter knowledge, we are testing phoneme awareness and these kind of things. In the next study, Maaike van der Mosten did for her PhD, happy she came with me to Paris today, she more explored, you may say, that auditory processing in the link between speech and, you may say, low-level auditory processing. She was discussing whether is it speech or is it even more basic, more elementary than speech, and is it really in the auditory domain? And Maaike used the factorial design with stimuli that have the same complexity. FM versus speech, this categorical perception, yeah, you cannot compare. We did it in Bart Butch's study, but given the complexity of this kind of it's very simple auditory material compared to the categorical perception. Maaike, in collaboration with Narli Golestani, who is in Geneva for the moment, did a factorial design where we made all conditions of the same complexity, temporal and non-temporal. For temporal, we already, and I can let, but now it's not Bach, but Ba and Da.
Ba, Da.
So again, this kind of categorical perception. If we take, instead of consonants, vowels, Then there, as you see, between these two, U and U, there is no dynamic in it. Again, only the second formant is different, but he is steady over time. And we again are changing this U in 10 steps until an U. Okay? And then to see what about non-speech, we rotated, and it's again an artificial thing, we rotated every you may say, energy that is above 2 kilohertz, 2,000 hertz, we rotate it against, and then you get very artificial sounds with the same complexity. So that's ba, da, but now rotated. And we do it again in 10 steps, and kids have to decide where is it. Is it the first, or is it the second that will... And we do the same with vowels. Oh. Okay, rotated speech. So this is non-speech, rotated speech, you may say, but non-speech, I don't think you hear speech in these kind of things, and speech, temporal, non-temporal, and we have four conditions. And what we see in adults, here we are using a group of students with dyslexia at our university compared to their, you may say, classmates, and we see that bada, as well as the rotated, artificially rotated bada, there is a significant difference between dyslexics and non-dyslexics, but not in the non-temporal domain. So the UU and the rotated UU is not. And we get more or less the same in kids. Again, bada, as you see, with kids it's more difficult, especially in the rotated here, bada. But there is a difference between the children who are dyslexics, and that were the children of Barbouch's study, but not in the non-temporal domain. So it seems as if these problems are specific for rapidly changing sounds, but not necessarily specific for speech. So already more basic auditory temporal processing deficit that is not purely linguistic in nature, you may say. Okay, now I will introduce you to some studies we are doing in that field on the more neural level. Is there some neurophysiological evidence, and we are using a technique, ESSRs, auditory steady state responses. And the basic theory is, if we look at that auditive temporal processing, so this kind of dynamic changing auditory stimuli, how will we look at them? You can say you have fast rate changes, more than 40 hertz. More than 20 hertz, but they are not that important for speech. If you look at speech and the interprocessing of speech is more in what is called the slow rate temporal processing, below 20 hertz, and you can say there is, I will make it clear, you may say until or more or less about 4 hertz. 4 hertz means that you have 4 changes in a cycle of 1 second. That is the syllabic rate. And at Dutch, when we analyze Dutch, we have a syllabic rate of about 4 syllables per second in running speech. And if you look at the phonemes, we have more or less in Dutch 19 to 20 phonemes in running speech per second. And you can see it here. I'm ambidextrous. That's more or less 4 syllables in 1 second, and if in a running speech, of course, in such a short utterance, you cannot see that much, but we would come until an average of 19 phonemes in 1 second in our language. We are using this knowledge in order to see how the brain is going on with this kind of modulations, this slow rate modulations. And we are offering a rhythmic auditory signal, I will give some examples later on, rhythmic basic auditory information. And what we see, and that's what the ASSRs are doing, is the frequency of this modulation peaks into the EEG, if we take EEG, electrophysiological measures at the scalp. In the frequency, we have, if you have here a certain frequency in the modulation, how fast goes it, you see a peak in the EEG spectrum, exactly at the frequency of that modulation. That, I don't know whether you are used, but in Flanders, we are using this technique also to detect deafness already in the first month after birth. Not with this kind of slow rate, but if you take 80 hertz, we know that 80 hertz, this peak is produced at the brainstem level, so very low level in the brain. And if we are presenting via earphones to very young kids, 1 month old, this kind of modulated modulated tones, and we don't see a reaction in the brainstem, then we know that the auditory stimulus is not arriving even at the brain, so there must be in an earlier phase, so in the middle ear or earlier on, a problem that leads to deafness. That's why, I don't know how it's in France, but in our country, kids are, and that has to do with the plasticity we need to use here, kids are implanted with cochlear implants at very, very, very young age so that they can relearn or learn to interpret this kind of auditory stimulus. We are using it in the slow rates. It's more difficult. You need more power to get these pictures. But so we have, you may say, build up speech in very elementary things, modulations at the syllable rate and modulations at the phoneme rate, in order to see how the brain of these kids, this is syllable rate. So you must imagine that the kid is laying down in a cabin, a Faraday cabin, with earphones, looking at a film, of course, without noise or without sound, and is for 10, 15 minutes hearing this kind of stimuli. And then at the same time, we are measuring their via the electrodes put on the cap on their head. We are measuring the signals. That's syllable rate, and you have. That's the speed of phonemes in spoken language. You may say, okay, it's very basically dumb. You don't hear speech anymore, but that's what we are trying to do. How is brain going on with this kind of modulations that are available in speech? First, the PhD of Hannah Poelmans. We tried it out first with adults, university students again, with a very simple design, 4 electrodes referenced, and we used 20 and 4 hertz, also 40 hertz, for 100% amplitude modulated, only to the right ear. And we use 2 kind of measures. Here you see what is happening. If you are offering this kind of this modulation at 20 hertz, if you look in the frequency domain, you had a peak in amplitude and energy, you may say, exactly at the rate of the frequency you offered. That's, and the quality of the brain processing is that signal to noise. How elaborated is this peak compared to, you may say, the frequencies who are just neighboring. The better this peak is coming out, the better this kind of modulation is processed at the brain level. And we are trying also to look at phase coherence. Is, you may say, is this kind of signal at a certain point in brain comes at the same time as another within intrahemispheric of between interhemispheric. And what we see in adults with dyslexia is that, again, in the left hemisphere, you should keep in mind that we are presenting monaural the right side, but that in the left hemisphere, in the 20 hertz condition, so the phonemic rate, there is less signal to noise ratio in dyslexics than in non-dyslexic adults, while we don't see differences in the right hemisphere for 20 hertz, and we don't see any difference in the syllable rate modulation. And if we look at intrahemispheric coherence, so the mastoid to the parietal electrodes, again, left and right, we see a difference, significant difference for the 20 hertz, but exactly the same for the 4 hertz. And again, intrahemispheric, if we see the coherence, the phase coherence between left and right hemisphere, again, differences in the 20 hertz. So it seems that normal syllabic rate, but deviant phonemic rate processing is going on in the adult brain of people with dyslexia. We see it in the left hemisphere signal-to-noise ratio and in the coherence within the hemispheres and between the hemispheres. At this moment, but I cannot present yet some results, we are doing the same with kids. We have done it already in kindergarten, and now they are in third grade, I think. So we are testing them every 2 years. So we want to see how this kind of processing is developing through the process of learning to read and spell. So from before reading to after reading, what we already see is that in the high-risk kids in kindergarten, they look different from adults, typical reading adults. So possibly also in that processing, there could be something happening. But Sophie van Voorn is at this moment finishing analysis and writing up. And we hope that in 2015, she will be able to defend her PhD on that topic on the kindergarten and the evolution from kindergarten to second grade in these kind of things. A last, and it's the second part of Mike's PhD, a last thing I want to, a technique I want to show you in from our lab is neurophysiological evidence via an MRI technique, and that's a structural technique, DTI, diffusion tensor imaging. So it's an MRI technique that gives an indication of, you may say, the integrity, directions, these kind of things, of white matter in the brain. So the, you may say, the brain material that is especially linked to transporting and connecting information. The idea is that we look with this technique how water molecules are diffused in the brain, or and you can compare it. If you have a big cup of coffee and you put in a little milk, then there is starting up a diffusion process, you may say. And if there is no borders, if you have a very big reservoir and you put in, then you see that the diffusion goes into all directions, right, three-dimensional, and is more or less forming, if you see the picture of the diffusion, a ball. If you put these kind of things in small tubes, what normally is in the case in white matter, who has long structures, then you get some directionality. And the what we are doing with this technique is trying to, we are, for every voxel, and I think if I'm right, Maike, we are, our voxels are more or less 2 to 2.5 millimeter sized. For every voxel in the brain, we are measuring this kind of tensor to see how the water is diffusing into that in that region. And the more directionality, the more chance that we are in white matter, while in gray matter we expect more both things. Why can DTI be important? Well, if you are talking about temporal, very fast and dynamic changes that has to be detected, then connectivity and myelination of so the white matter material will be involved. And the second thing is we are interested in how through learning to read, how a network is developing, since our brain is not made for reading. Professor Dehaene showed the ape, the primates, they couldn't read, so we use our brain to read. So there must build up a kind of a network that is used for reading throughout that reading instruction period. And that's why we think that this technique could help us. So we are using two measures. If you have all parameters of such a tensor, you can summarize it into one measure, and that's what's called fractional anisotropy. And that's a kind of, you may say, that gives an idea about the directionality and the integrity of this white matter. But we can use also this kind of information to see where the tracts in the brain are running. So by using the directionality in the tensor, there are techniques, what we call fiber tracking, to detect how the tracts in the brain are going on, and by combining them, what the quality of these kind of tracts is. Again, I will not go into detail about the subjects. Mike did it on adult readers, so university students of third year, I think, 21, 22 years old, who are very, as you see here, severely hindered in their reading development, although they are doing master studies at our university, and especially their phonemic awareness is hindered, and also orthographic processing. So what have we done? Well, in what we didn't do, but there is a bunch of research on functional imaging in the brain, and what has been shown is that there are, you may say, more or less three important regions that are activated when we are confronted with words and we have to read words, these three regions. And you may say two of them are more or less linked to what is called the phonological aspects of reading. The red ones here in the temporal, parietal, and inferior frontal region. And there are more what we call the ventral stream, more involved in orthographic aspects, these blue ones. And what has been shown is that there seems to be neural anomalies in dyslexics, so some problems in dyslexics in these two parts of the brain. What we do with the DTI is we try to look at the tracts that are going through these kind of things, and I will show you how it works a little bit. With this technique, we can build up all these fibers. As you see, you can make a picture of all these fibers, and then we use, that's the arcuati fasciculus, that's a bundle that is linked to, that is linking, you may say, the red with the direct part here, the red and the orange posterior part. And we have the EFOF that is, you may say, more what the ventral stream, the linking, you may say, the blue spots that we found out by fMRI, that's the inferior frontal occipital fasciculus, the EFOF, as we say. And so we did the same. This is the left hemisphere, but we did the same with the right hemisphere. And what we see, and that was mentioned, that's also used in our science paper, that is that in this left red line, you may say arcuati fasciculus, there is a difference in this quality, you may say, of that connection, the FA, so the fractional anisotropy measure of that tract is of a lower quality in dyslexics versus non-dyslexics, while the blue line and the orange, not yet. But what is more interesting, in the right, we don't find differences. And even more interesting is that there are good correlations between this arcuati fasciculus in the left and phoneme awareness. There is a significant correlation between how well kids are performing, or here adults are performing, in phonological phoneme awareness tasks and the FA of that Speech noise is more linked, you may say, to the posterior part of the articulatory fasciculus. And the blue line, the left EFOF, is linked to orthographic skills. And I think, knowing that what this has been mentioned also in the lesson before, the visual word form area involved also here, it is, of course, seems reasonable that there is a correlation between the blue, the quality of this blue tract and orthography. We see no significant correlations in the right hemisphere. So it seems that in, especially in the dorsal stream, that is, so in the left articulatory fasciculus, there is a lower FA in dyslexic adults, no group differences in the blue, and that corresponds to, you may say, the phonological route of reading, while the orthographical route seems in our population we have tested, there seem no problems, no involvement of right hemispheric tracts. But, of course, one of the things is, if you find it in adult dyslexics, is that the cause or the consequence of a history of reading problems, and is it really a primary deficit of dyslexia? Is it already there when we look at kids before reading? Keeping in mind that especially white matter is very plastic, there must be all kind of changes throughout development. And you may say a standard hypothesis we have built up is that I could imagine that if we know in a transparent language as Dutch that we are starting with a phonological reading route, you may say, in learning to read and later on use more orthographical of direct recognition route, there must be an evolution possibly in dyslexics where we start with a difficulty in that more dorsal route, and later on as a secondary deficit we will see problems, or that at least our hypothesis in the ventral regions. And that's what we try to do, and with the same design now, a bigger group, but kids again from families with dyslexia, we are trying to test them before learning to read, so at kindergarten age. We have built up a whole protocol. The big problem with this kind of techniques is if you may want to make, you may say, a nice picture of the brain, people must lay down very, very, very still. And to ask kids this kind of processing procedure costs more or less, I think, 12 to 15 minutes. So our kids need to be lay still, absolutely still, as long as possible, so for 12 minutes at least. And that's not what the kids are used to. So we have a training scheme developed via all kind of games to learn them, to go into the scanner. The training costs more or less 1 hour to have them for 12 minutes lay down in the scanner to do this kind of analysis. So that's. But we were, and has been published by Catherine Thijs, our protocol, and the motion parameters are very, very nice. Okay, what do we find? And to conclude, at this moment we have analyzed the pre-reading data, and we see that not in the articulatory fasciculus, what we were hypothesizing, but especially in the left EFOF, so the blue line, the dorsal, and in the posterior part that were not involved in adults, there we find differences between high-risk and low-risk kids. We don't know whether they are dyslexic or not, but at least the risk is there. But above, we see phonological awareness is correlated to all of these tracts. And later knowledge also to the EFOF, that was what could be expected. But also phonological awareness is highly correlated to the blue tract, you may say, even in the right hemisphere. And phonological awareness is the only predictor in all these tracts, these three brain tracts, that is significantly related to the, you may say, the fractional anisotropy, so the quality of this kind of vessel. So what we see is that not the arcuate fasciculus, but the other parts who were not involved in the adults, or now between high-risk and low-risk kids, hindered or of a less quality, you may say, but all or more or less linked to phonology. So possibly there is some anomalies, there are some problems in the white matter already pre-reading, located in the ventral and the dorsal connections. That's opposed to the standard neuroanatomical model we were testing. But phonological awareness is sustained bilaterally and by both tracts. So we could imagine that lateralization of this kind of function still needs to be done in these kind of brains. So there is no specialization towards phonology versus orthographic processing. And of course, follow-up needs to be done. Kids have now been tested after 2 years of reading, but the data are on the computer, but not yet analyzed. So longitudinal follow-up is needed, and we are very eager to see what will come out throughout this development of reading from 5 years on until 10, 12 years old kids. So thank you for your attention. And I want to thank, of course, as you have already understood, this is not my work, this is the work of a whole team. And I want to mention both my group at the Parenting and Special Education Department of our university and the group of Jan Wouters, so these are the Department of Neuroscience, Experimental Otorhinolaryngology, as we call it, and of course the Radiology Department of Professor Sunard in the Medicine in the University Hospital. Thank you very much.